The Disciplined Investor is underwritten by Interactive Brokers. Interactive Brokers charges U.S. dollar margin loan rates from 0.75% to 1.59%. Rates, of course, subject to change. Learn more at ibkr.com/compare.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Diversification, sectors, asset classes, alternatives. We're talking about the benefits, the detractors of mutual funds and ETFs. We got it all for you with our special guest, Kevin Hoffman. Yep, right from Horowitz & Company. All this and much more on episode number 716 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello, welcome to the show. Welcome to the end of May 2021. Hope you're having a great Memorial Day weekend. My wish for you is to have a wonderful barbecue with family and friends, spending some time outdoors because God knows we've been cooped up for a long time. A lot of people outside Florida, especially. Yes, I'm in Florida. Yes, I'm Andrew Horowitz, by the way. I am the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as the co-host of DH Unplugged. Each and every Tuesday, we launch that with John C. Dvorak and myself, and we really focus in on all of the, well, I call it the lighter side of the news, but really digging down into what's going on behind the headlines when it comes to finance. Well, today we got a special show, something I've been working on for a while. Wanted to really wrap up some of the conversations that we've been having over the last several weeks. The idea behind really, how do you achieve that perfect level of diversification? And let me, quick spoiler alert here, there is no perfect level of diversification. There's no perfect portfolio. It has to be adjusted, massaged, and rebalanced. It has to be looked at. It has to be cared for. It has to be taken care of over time. The fact of the matter is that there is no such thing that I could think of when we're working on the idea of diversification in a static portfolio, something that you just put together when you're 25 and just let it do its thing till you're 60. Times change, things change, needs change, ideas change, markets change. I will tell you that since I have been doing this when I was in my 20s, markets are completely different. I hate to break it to you, but we didn't have internet back then. We barely had cell phones. They were just coming out. And things change. And this is part and parcel to what you really want to be focusing in and really taking from this conversation that we're going to have today, because I think it's really important to understand it and grab onto it, to really internalize some of the things that we're going to give to you today that I think would be very helpful. Again, in an hour or so, 2 hours, 3 hours, we can't get to every bit of information that you need to get that level of diversification, that portfolio set. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes, but we're going to give you, I hope, at least a good amount of that. So let's get on with that conversation. Let's get the microphones turned on here. Let's get everything going. Everybody ready? All right, let's get it on. And our guest today is Kevin Hoffman, and we're going to get a lot from Kevin. You know him because he's been around for a long time, and I get great reviews on every time Kevin comes on. Working at Horowitz & Company for the past, 10, 11, 12 years, and does a lot of work in the area of research and offers up clients all sorts of information, but also is really the heart of the information and portfolio design and overall asset allocation. So I thought we'd really get down and dirty into that whole thing. And there's some things that you need to know, by the way, Kevin, since the last time you've been on. A lot of changes in your life, right?
That's for sure, yeah.
What do you got? What do you got for us?
I got two things. two. I got a boy and a boy, so I got two twins. Yeah,
that's good.
Yep, born December last year, so it's been lack of sleep and a little tiring as of late.
I know you kind of look like you need an eye lift.
That's for sure.
So what do we got? We got Alexander.
Yep, Alexander and Caden.
Caden, so wonderful. Back in December and. Kind of crazy time to have kids with all of what's gone on, but you guys gotten through it pretty well.
Yeah, we're getting the hang of it. You know, it's just it's a process.
Not as easy as you thought it was going to be, huh?
No, definitely not. Seems like one would be rather easy though. Yeah. I'm not sure. We'll see.
Well, I got twins too. It's not. I always say when you have twins, it's not 1 + 1 = 2.
No,
it's a whole
exponential.
Right. Exactly. Just wait. Yep. And then I had another child, and what happens is now you can't even get a table for four. You know, you can't get a decent booth.
Oh, there's no more. There's no more after this. This is done. That's for sure.
Well, you're well diversified in the area of kids. Let's put it that way. So so I thought what we'd do is really break down the area of diversification because, you know, for the last several weeks, I've been talking about this whole idea of, okay, 1 foot in, 1 foot out, or 1 foot out, 1 foot in, the whole thing about, you know, where do you want to be in terms of your portfolio? You know, what's going on with regard to how do you properly protect yourself in certain circumstances? And one of the things I continually see, and you see it all the time too, is somebody brings you a portfolio. It's like, oh, you know, I got a lot of things in my portfolio and I think I'm doing pretty well. But it's like the same thing over and over, right? You know, they have large cap growth, then they have technology funds and they have a healthcare fund. And it doesn't, you know, what the whole idea of what really is diversification. And then I guess we have to talk about, you know, if there's any benefits these days of what's going on. So let's start with the concept of diversification. Okay, so where do we start?
Yeah, so it really boils down to, you know, what's the point? And the point is that, you know, you need to construct a portfolio that's, I guess, you know, to the risk that you want to have for your, you know, your investments and which way they're going to go, up, down, you know, how fast they're going to move. But really, you want to get that model portfolio or that construction done. Because as we know, timing the market is almost impossible.
Yeah.
And doing it for any length of time will assuredly make you go mad or broke. You know, unless you have some sort of insider information or you're in a Madoff type portfolio, you know, timing markets, you know, it's not easy. But, for the average, you know, retail investor or even, you know, average institutional investor, I'd wager to say it's almost impossible.
I haven't even heard of any market timing models in the longest time.
Yeah, I just don't think they exist anymore. I mean, I think, you know, you still have some hedge funds out there who may have some, you know, black boxes or whatever that can see ahead of the market. And, you know, they're in and out very, very quickly. But market timing, you know, moving in and out on your portfolio on either a daily or monthly or yearly basis, just, you know, it just doesn't work, especially as emotional as we are as human beings. You know, and some of these examples you can see is, you know, when the COVID crash happened, everybody thought the world was ending. You know, you had this gigantic market move lower, you know, 20-30%, and you had some people sell out. Now, the point is, you know, when do you get back in? That's the hardest part is, you know, do I try and pick a bottom? And in that case, you know, you may pick the wrong bottom and then lose more money. Or, you know, you never get back in. And people have been, you know, not getting back in since the 2008 financial crisis.
I like that. Wait. People have not been getting back in.
Yeah.
I know.
No, they haven't. I mean, people are still on the sidelines because they're scarred for life.
I'm waiting for 650 on the Dow again.
That's right.
Or the S&P, I should say. Or maybe the Dow, for that matter. But, you know, it's interesting because I remember fielding a lot of calls back then when the market was coming in. And we've been at this a long time, right? We get a lot of different calls. But one of the calls that really sticks out to me, I'll never forget it. There was two of them. One of them was a woman who panicked and freaked out and was going to sell everything out and said, I don't know what to do. I can't deal with this. I don't know what's happening. And said, please take over. Please take this all over. I'm like, okay. And we got her back in right where she should have been for her. And she had this enormous growth over that year. Okay. But the other one that really sticks out to me that's really interesting is this gentleman calls me and he starts rationalizing. Well, I think this is going to happen because that's going to happen. Well, I think we're going to go a bit lower, even though the market's starting to pick up. And I know the Fed's there and this whole thing. And he says, I'm waiting for this. I'm waiting for that and all that. I'm like, okay. He goes, I missed a lot of it. I think it was May. I missed a lot of the move from the March bottom. But however, he keeps going into this rationale with me, right?
Right,
and I'm thinking,
right.
And I said to him, stop. What is it going to take? And what and the main thing, what if you're wrong?
Right.
What if you're wrong? And that was a big, for me, especially as I was kind of really, I wasn't debating with him. I was more like pinning him down and arguing with him and trying to, you know, smack him in the head and get some answers here, which he didn't have. And I would venture to say he's probably still out of the market.
That's very possible. And the point is that, you know, if we look historically over a long, long period of time, you know, being invested and your time in the market, you know, will create those returns. So, you know, getting in and out, in and out, in and out, like I said, it'll drive you mad. But if you keep that time in the market, you create a well-diversified portfolio with various different non-correlated asset classes, then, you know, it gives you the best chance to, you know, produce returns over time.
That doesn't mean that you have to be aggressive or conservative. You can be a range.
Right. You can be a range. You know, you can have cash on the sidelines. You can, you know, create a conservative portfolio. You can create an aggressive portfolio. You know, you can create somewhere in between. But, you know, the whole point is, you know, when one thing goes bad, you want another thing to lift it up or to soften that blow. But the whole point is, you know, keep it simple. Stay in, you know, but stay in with something that's tried and true. And, you know, been proven over time, you know, with some sort of a developed plan of action, you know, rather than just throwing it into a bunch of different random stocks or random sectors or whatever, you know, you got to create those, that portfolio that doesn't have those idiosyncratic risks or those risks that are, you know, individual company basis. So, you know, what we do is, you know, what Andrew's probably talked about several times over the years is this flower garden theory that, you know, you have certain investments that produce, you know, maybe in the springtime, you know, same thing with your annuals or your perennials or, you know, those beautiful flowers. But then you have some things like annuals, those evergreens that are always just going to kind of continue, you know, producing slow, steady returns over time. And some of those can kind of be related to bonds. You know, bonds have been out of vogue for a long, long period of time. And that's, you know, because interest rates have been.
But only on a yield basis, right? I mean, they've been making tons of money.
Right.
It's only on a yield basis.
And that's the thing is, you know, like you said, you know, interest rates have been low, but still a lot of these bonds in principle have grown. And, you know, you could sell them for a higher profit because as the yields drop, let's say you have a 5% bond. If a yield drops down to 1%, that bond is now worth more money than when you bought it in the beginning. So we've seen a lot of growth in bonds and a lot of return from bonds, whether it be, you know, in a mutual fund or an ETF, or even if you were to, you know, sell that bond before it matures. So, you know, really it's having those lower, like the slower growth type investments and those higher growth type investments, some with less volatility and some with more volatility.
Right.
Trying to find that good asset mix. I'm sure everybody's seen that.
There is a mix. There's a mix. There is something for everybody.
The efficient frontier. You know, I'm sure many people have seen that before. You know, it's the graph showing, you know, your risk versus return. And you want to find some way to match that up with your own risk tolerance. You know, how much pain can you take before you can't sleep at night?
Right.
You know, or even below that. You know, you just got to find that good balance. And that's what a financial advisor or an investment management firm is there to do for you, to help you, you know, walk you through that.
So I want to mention something. You know, you sparked something here that I never really thought of before. But of course, we've been kind of talking about and trying to give this metaphor and this kind of graphical look at, all right, what's a flower garden? How does it look? How do you want your portfolio look? And I started to think, by the way, everybody that knows, anybody that follows me has been around for a while, you know that Kevin and I do a lot of fishing together. And I'm going to give you the ship at sea theory that I just somehow created just now. Okay. This is in a working process right now. But having a ship at sea and you're driving, you get into an island. So let's say you're kind of on a beeline, you got a course, you got your autopilot, you set the heading of your compass. If you're lucky enough to have an autopilot that works, you start working across and you're getting across that ocean, you're going to be there. But all of a sudden, everything looks great, smooth sailing. There's a giant storm that's approaching and you're investing. It doesn't mean if you set your portfolio up, which would be your boat, by the way, and you're moving that portfolio towards a particular goal, that you necessarily have to sail right through the eye of the storm, okay? You can take a little bit of a left turn or a right turn around it. It may take you a little bit longer to get to your place, but you'll get there, right? So the eye of the storm in this case would, of course, be an entire market correction. So what we're doing here is we're kind of steering a few degrees to the left, or to the port for those of you in the boating arena, or to starboard or whatever it may be, okay? Or maybe we're kind of slowing down for a little while, waiting for something to pass. Maybe we're anchoring up in a harbor for a little while, which would be kind of like moving a little bit more towards cash, fixed income, et cetera. So think of that, whereas you can be boating and you can be getting somewhere eventually. Sometimes you need to make a course correction in order to get there. I don't know. I just thought of that.
That works too. Yeah. And you may need to have the right vessel for your plan. You know, if you have a little small canoe, you may not even want to go out that day.
Right.
You know, but if you have a large aircraft carrier, you know, you might be able to storm that storm, you know?
Right. But no, my point is that the thing is, though, that there are no set it and forget it in concept. There are places that probably give us a better overall feeling and emotional ability to deal with the storms and all the problems. But, you know, anything that we deal with in the world of investing has risk. That's just a fact, right?
Right.
And we need to deal with that, but deal with it in an intelligent way that provides us what we want out of this whole process, which is long-term financial stability, security, and independence. Really, that's what we're looking for, right?
Right. And those are the benefits of diversification. Now, you know, some of the detractors might be that, you know, you don't get to go to the cocktail party and brag about, you know, your 100, 200, 300, you know, 400% growth on your cryptocurrency that you had.
Right. Darling, let me show you my asset allocation.
Exactly.
That's not a fun topic.
It's boring. Yeah. You know, diversification and portfolio modeling and, you know, staying it in for the long haul, it's boring. Nobody wants to hear that. Yeah. You know, nobody wants to, you know, talk about that. You know, everybody wants to talk about the home runs, you know, the amount of money that they made on their Dogecoin last week, or, you know, the amount of money that they made on, you know, Ethereum or all these newfangled fancy things. And there's a place for that. You know, if that's something that you want to do, you know, you play with that a little bit on the side. You know, you make an allocation toward that, maybe a 1-5% allocation that, you know, you seek out alternative investments or different things that, you know, could potentially be non-correlated. You know, as we know, cryptocurrency is supposed to be the newest, you know, non-correlated asset class. Whether or not that stays true or not, yeah, I'm not a big fan, but that's just me.
So let's get down to now this whole idea of diversification. Let's talk about asset allocation. Let's talk about that. That's where we start, right? We start with the bigger picture of, okay, how much do we want to allocate to certain areas of the markets? And those areas, they're broad-based, used to be just considered in the old days, it was three things, really. It was stocks, bonds, cash. That's kind of the old model.
Right.
And they kind of slipped into a little real estate somewhere in there,
right,
as kind of that positioning. And probably right now you can, I think that one other thing that we want to put into that very big picture would be alternatives,
right,
into the big picture asset allocation.
Right.
And there was all sorts of rules of thumbs over the years, right? I mean, a rule of thumb, there was, you subtract your age from 100 and you get how much you're supposed to be in stocks at any given time. And there was the old 60-40 portfolio.
Right.
That was kind of, I don't know where that came from. That was like the thing.
Right.
You know, that was like the greatest opportunity with the least amount of risk. But once we get to that point, and before we get there, how do we even determine that? How do we determine the exact amount? How would you, but how would the listener determine how much stock they should have in their portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really a difficult question because it's something that even we have to go through with clients and figure out, you know, what kind of a risk tolerance that they have. And that's really, you know, your starting point is, you know, how much risk am I willing to take? You know, am I okay with 20% loss in my portfolio? Am I okay with a 40% loss in my portfolio as long as I can make 100%? You know, it just really depends. You know, some people out there, they don't want to lose a dime. And that's difficult because right now there's no way to get any kind of guaranteed returns. You know, interest rates are low. Money markets are paying what?
Nothing.
A quarter? Quarter
Maybe
percent?
Quarter, half if you're really, really lucky.
Right. So, you know, you kind of have to, you know, there is some, you know, putting the faith in the system and trust in the system, which, you know, right now is a big problem. But, you know, for many people, considering political environment, inflation that's out there, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of the macroeconomics are difficult to get a grasp on. But, you know, really you have to ask yourself, how much risk am I willing to take? And, you know, there's several questionnaires out there that you can take to try and decide, you know, how much risk you should take or what your portfolio should kind of look like.
How about this for an easy one? Very easy. if we pick a, let's just go back to the original, which is, and make it very easy, we'll just do stocks and bonds. Right. Just say, you know, how much, really the question is how much stocks I have in my portfolio. That's the risk factor, right?
Yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, equity side, whether it be international, right. domestic.
But let's talk about that. So let's say that we have, let's make it really easy. We have 50% equity. Is that right for me? Well, let's talk about, well, how much pain should you take? Again, this is a very easy, very basic, very 101 level of the concept of how to start the process. If you have a 50% overall allocation just to equities, let's say that then we have a 20% market correction.
Right.
Your everyday market correction, 20%, and you have a 20% allocation to equities through mutual funds or ETFs, by the way, diversified.
Right.
You are going to have half of the risk on the downside, basically. If you have individual stocks, you'll probably have about 60, 65% of the same risk if you're diversified, individual right. stocks. You know, if right. you have one stock, you could have a lot more.
Right.
So the starting point, if you are thinking about investing in a diversified portfolio, a basket kind of level where you have ETFs or mutual funds, is that if you can take the amount of equities, match that to what the potential downstroke in a portfolio or in an index is going to be in a tough time, and say that's acceptable to me, that's fine. Now realize that over the last 10, 15 years, every single down that we've had has actually been the best opportunity to buy when the blood was in the street. You know, there was
right.
V moves. That doesn't happen all the time, though. They can be elongated. And more importantly, you don't want that down to happen right when you need your money. So it depends on where you are and all that. So let's go with that concept of, okay, I got 50-50. And then you can kind of play around with that, right? Because you could say, well, maybe I want more aggressive bonds or more real estate in my portfolio. Maybe I want more alternatives. Maybe I want to have some small caps, et cetera. So the first level is this asset allocation model that you set up and where you want to be, where you can set that up. For example, in Excel, just say, what am I going to have? Okay. Second, we go where? Sectors, right? So kind of walk me through a little bit about the idea of what is kind of within the various sectors.
Well, I mean, certainly if you're looking at broad-based sector allocation, you're talking about, you know, technology, you're talking about banks, you're talking about, you know, all the various different industries that are out there. But, you know, a lot of times those mutual funds or those ETFs will kind of skew their allocations toward those different sectors based on the current environment. You know, if you're looking at, you know, U.S. large cap stocks, a lot of them are broken up into, you know, the Apples of today or the, you know, the big technology companies. But really, you know, when you build this model, you have to, you know, invest, but then you have to monitor those particular investments. You have to rebalance back to your model portfolio, evaluate those underlying managers, and then adjust based on certain macroeconomic events and fine tune those, you know, based on assets or classes that are, you know, in favor or not in favor. And a lot of those have to do with the underlying macroeconomic trends, whether it be inflation, whether it be, you know, the Federal Reserve is stimulating the economy, whether they're pulling money out of the economy, you know, what the political environment might be if there's, you know, a political stimulus, whether it be through taxation or you know, lower taxation.
So, but that's actually country by country, because if that's kind of gets hard after a while, like, okay, so I understand what's going on in the U.S. I got that. I think I understand. You never really understand, but I think I understand what's happening in the U.S. from the aspect of what is going to be the fiscal side, what is going to be the monetary side. I think I get that. I think I understand what's happening with the economy. Okay, you go through all of that. Then you're like, all right, now where else am I going to invest? Well, I'm thinking about maybe I like Asia or Latin America or Europe or emerging Europe. Or you look at these and you say, now I have to go through the same process. And that's where it becomes difficult for people.
Right, right. And that's where, you know, getting a professional money manager or mutual fund type investment is one of the better ways to go, because they have the boots on the ground. They have people talking to the companies over there, meeting with the companies, knowing the current political environment. You know, and while the U.S., you know, may be the driving force of the, you know, global type economy, there's still a lot of different nuances when it comes to foreign investing, you know, with currency risk and political risk and whatnot. So, yeah. You know, having those mutual fund investor or those mutual fund managers, you know, be able to evaluate those things and get you in the right companies. That's, you know, that's one of the best things that you can do. And finding those mutual fund managers is something that we do best.
Right. Let me just take a quick break because this happens to be, what we're going to talk about right now with Interactive Brokers is kind of right on line with what we're talking about, unplanned, frankly. But what I want to talk about, I want to really get into some of the areas that people probably don't do a lot of research in, like emerging markets, foreign, talk about SMID, micros, tilting. There's a few things I want to talk about there. But before we do so, this kind of works really well with this discussion because the question that we started with is, you know, how do you know where you are, right? So I want you to consider Portfolio Analyst, which is powered by Interactive Brokers, because this helps sophisticated investors understand the health of their complete financial portfolio. Portfolio Analyst is free and it's easy to use. It's personal finance software that creates a consolidated view of banking, brokerage, and credit card accounts. What you could do is you can compare your consolidated portfolio against more than 200 benchmarks, or you can even create customized benchmarks for analyzing performance. You can calculate time and money-weighted rate of returns and use Portfolio Analyst for forecasting, which is pretty cool. So what I want you to do is check it out. Go over to and sign up for free at PortfolioAnalyst.com. Kind of unplanned but interesting how that actually works with what we're talking about today, which is kind of discovering where you are, what to do, how to do it. But, let me just back up to all. I'm going to rewind this all the way to the beginning. The whole point is also having an understanding before you could do any of this, right, of where you are, who you are.
Right.
Because if you don't know where you are and you don't know who you are and maybe even a little bit of futuristic look in who you're going to be.
Right.
You know, and which is also the discussion we talked about. You just had a couple of kids. And I remember for years I'm like, you don't understand yet, you'll know soon. You don't understand yet, you'll know eventually. And you're like, what are you talking about? Now it's like, I get it. So the thing is, you know, like a lot of the times when we look at our parents or elders or people that have done this before and realize, hey, that will be us eventually in terms of how we want to take income from our portfolio, or maybe we have to get more tax advantage at a younger level or a younger age. Or I mean, all this kind of flows in. But the point is where I am, who I am, who am I going to be, and try to understand that as you go through this process. So let's talk about some of the areas within a portfolio. Equities. You could add risk and tweak a portfolio by adding diversification in a much more risky asset class that actually brings down risk. Now, how is that possible?
Well, it's possible because it's a non-correlated asset class. And, you know, typically, you know, risk is measured by either volatility or standard deviation. And when one asset class goes one way, you know, whether it be down or up, down in the case of, you know, what most people think of as risk,
right,
then, you know, maybe that other asset class that is maybe riskier, you know, based on volatility, it may go up. So, you know, a lot of times you have things like commodities or even emerging markets where the U.S. markets may go down and they may continue higher. Or
well, classic example was last year and this year, right? Growth versus value.
Right.
Classic, great example of, wait a minute, what's happening?
Right. So growth's been outperforming value for, it's got to be at least 3, 4, or 5 years now.
I think it's 5 years now.
And also, you know, U.S. equities have also been on fire for the past...
Ever.
For at least 10 years. So, you know, that's one of the issues with diversification in that, you know, you may miss out on some of this growth, but, you know, if everybody had that magic eight ball and they could look back, you know, investing would be easy. But a lot of times we don't have that foresight. So, you know, being diversified amongst all these different asset classes actually helps you, you know, take down that risk, create that smooth return over time, and being in the market, you know, with a safe and balanced portfolio based on, you know, your risk tolerance and time horizon.
But I got to stop you because, you know, you said, well, you know, you may not make that much money and all that, but that's under certain periods. For example, value blew the crap out of growth for years.
Right.
Then growth came in, it kind of switched over again. And then, you know, right now you look at the differential this year is ridiculous. Now this year or last maybe, where are we now? We're in May, June. So 7 months, 8 months has been unbelievable to the side of value. So the thing that you have to really wonder is when you look at this, what's your time horizon, which was something we'll get to in a second. But that's a big point because you may not be making the money today. Then again, you know, look at all the fangs, the, you know, what they call them, Woodstocks now, the Woodstocks. Kathy Wood, the ARK investment stocks, got just obliterated for a period. The SPACs down 30, 40, 50, 60%. But the thing is, you look at something like...
But if you look at the overall market, it's still up.
Right.
No, that's the interesting thing. You know, if you're talking about diversification, that's when it really helps you out.
But it's also, I see it as a hole filler. So it's kind of like... you may have emerging markets that may be on their own, necessarily standalone, a higher level of what's called standard deviation of volatility. Let's just look at it as volatility. We know what that is. We don't have to really get through all the fancy words here, downside deviation and all the different alpha betas and all that. But the point is, when we look at volatility, which is kind of the range, and the only thing we really care about is downside volatility, because upside volatility everybody's fine with. But you put emerging markets in the portfolio as an example. You look historically, there have been years that they have just been on fire.
Yep.
Crazy.
Right.
Other years, they're kind of just doing their thing. Now, they actually can work with, it's like an enhancer. It's kind of like vermouth in a martini, you know, where you just get, it doesn't really change a lot there, but it's something's going on.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right.
And what's happening is that you have this, this opportunity to do that, add things like SMID. Let's talk about SMID for a second, which we use in the area of a foreign.
Right. Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Well, first tell everybody what that is.
Well, so SMID is a mixture of both small and mid-cap companies, and that's, you know, small mid-cap is, you know, the size of the company and its market value. So in the small and mid-cap space in the U.S., you know, you may have companies that are worth between $100 million and $3 billion on the small side and, $3 billion to $10 billion on the mid size. And, you know, this is kind of, you know, an area where there's a little bit more volatility, a little bit more standard deviation, and, you know, many times a higher beta to large cap stocks that are both foreign and domestic. But there's a great opportunity here in that, you know, a lot of times these small and mid-cap companies are innovators and they're growing and they move from, you know, small to mid-cap and then mid-cap to large-cap. You know, we've seen this in the past with, companies like AMD or Intel or...
They start out as puppies and grow up into big dogs eventually.
Right, and if you stay invested in those for a longer period of time and you pick some good winners, then, you know, those companies will produce some significant returns. So, you know, when you're building your portfolio, you don't want to just look at the big name companies that are, you know, across the board like IBM and Apple and Google. You know, you want to look at some of these up and coming type companies, you know, or, you know, smaller companies that, you know, are value based that, you know, just produce consistent returns over time. So, you know, finding that asset mix is not just, you know, investing straight in equities. You know, there's underlying sectors in there, which could be, you know, like you said, value versus growth, small versus mid.
And some of this is all about your macroeconomic outlook and really your viewpoint on the world's, you know, where the world is going in terms of, okay, well, valuations. Well, the U.S. market versus the Europe. Europe is a much better quote unquote valuation right now. Now, is it a lower valuation and is the growth levels at a point where they deserve to actually have that, whereas we are overvalued? Well, that could be. But if that's the case, then maybe the U.S. is going to come down in terms of valuation meeting price, and Europe will either stagnate or come up a little bit. Either way, it's still benefiting the Europe side. Look at, for example, the areas of value versus growth. You know, do you invest in value, which we are tilted, we kind of slanted and have a tweak position more towards value than growth. Not so much that we don't have any growth at all, but enough to make a difference. And do you do that because you believe that interest rates are starting to come up and build that concept of where are we? Inflation is going to be higher, interest rates are going to be up. Would I prefer to be in value or growth? Well, we know historically value has been better. We know that the dollar will do certain things well. The dollar higher versus lower, how is that going to impact for example, emerging markets or foreign markets, and kind of go through that process, right? You know, where is the outlook as I look around, and then almost put a weighting on it. I'm trying to make this easy for the people out there, right? I know how we do it. We have a very complex process of doing all this.
Right.
But I'm trying to make it easy where you kind of, okay, well, if I have a 1 to 10, this is the most important. If inflation's the most important, then maybe I don't want to be near necessarily growth stocks. I want to be near value. I put a weighting of a 3 on growth and a 7 out of 10 on value. As an example, I may say the dollar, I think the dollar is going to be really skyrocketing. Well, that's the case. It's not going to be necessarily possibly good for things like emerging markets, and it could be a problem for other areas. I may put a 2 on that. Or inflation is going to be major. Hey, maybe put an 8 on my gold, my silver, my commodities positioning, and my if interest rates are going to come up, if I look at bonds, the longest term bonds, I may say that's a 1, where the shortest term bonds, I'll put an 8 or a 9 on, you know, and kind of say that's how I want to slope it out.
Yeah, I mean, you're starting to get a little complicated because, you know, you're throwing in a bunch of different things into this recipe of, you know, what am I cooking here? But, you know, maybe you put too much pepper in and you totally, you know, screw up the whole thing. Yeah. So, you know, the question you have to ask yourself is, you know, what if I'm wrong? You know, what if I'm wrong on this particular bet?
What if I'm wrong?
Is it going to hurt me? You know, is it really going to destroy, you know, my potential for my portfolio to grow, or is it really going to detract my portfolio from growing? So, you know,
but that's back with keeping a reasonable level of balance, right?
Right. That's the whole point of being diversified.
Right. Is there over diversification potential?
There always is, but you know,
what does that look like?
Just having every single mutual fund in the book.
You have every mutual fund and ETF.
Yeah, every single ETF. I mean, you can trade for free nowadays, so you might as well just buy them all, right?
Right, yeah, buy partial shares of all, too. So, yeah, there is over-diversification. There's no need to get crazy about this. But, again, it's the risk is really what we're looking at is short-term risk of downside and weighing that over our long-term of – so you look at a chart and you see like a 15-minute chart that's really bouncing all over the place, right? And like, oh, look at those moves, ups and downs. Then you go to a daily chart and you're like, okay, there's the same move, but it doesn't look as major. You go to a weekly chart, a monthly chart, an annual chart. All of a sudden, it smooths out. So I think when we talk about this diversification, asset allocation, sector allocation, risk factors and all that, I think there's an important point that we need to stop and think about time horizon.
Right.
I mean, how important is that in the big picture?
That's a huge portion of it. And mostly because, you know, the more time that you have available to you, the greater the possibility that, you know, historically, looking back, you know, historically that, you know, your portfolio will continue to grow and it will grow in an exponential way. So, you know, many times, you know, you hear about, you know, endowments. They have an infinite time horizon because, you know, they're always going to get donations. They're always going to have money coming in, you know, unless for some reason the whole college establishment.
Well, but it's the same thing with charities.
Charities. Yeah. You have, you know, infinite time horizon for investing. Now, you know, if you're talking to a 70-year-old or an 80-year-old, you know, and they need that money and they only have their Social Security, you may not want to be investing in something that's highly risky where, you know, if a 2008 type event happens or even COVID happens or something like that, then, you know, they can't afford to lose 50% of their portfolio or 40% or 20% even for that matter, because they're living off of that money. So you'd have to construct something a little bit more conservative. Now, somebody who's just out of college who, you know, may not necessarily need their savings money as they're making salary or making income, and
They can replace their losses. That's the point, right?
Right, and they have the potential for their earnings to go up over time. You know, those are the people that we can take a little bit more risk with, in the fact that, you know, as long as you are aggressive but smartly aggressive, you know, not just throwing it into some random investments here and there, you know, building an aggressive portfolio, then, you know, you have that time to kind of recoup those investment losses should there be some sort of short-term downside. And also, they have the ability to continue to invest new wages, new earnings, so you have that kind of dollar cost averaging that happens over time. And, you know, while you're young, you may not have a lot of money to invest, but, you know, we know that as your portfolio grows, what's the word I'm looking for? The interest, it's
the compounding effect.
Compounding, yeah, interest compounds over time. So, you know, the compounding effect of interest is you know, it's amazing.
So it's one of the big things right there is the whole idea that again, I'm going to bring it back to what we do. One of the things that we have is when we have an asset allocation that may be appropriate dependent on your particular level of risk, then we add in the mix that extra salt at the end, because you brought up the recipes, for goodness sakes. You bring in the little salt on the end just to figure, or not, to figure out, well, is it too salty, too vinegary, is it too sweet, and kind of balance it out with what your risk tolerance is. How long do you have?
Right.
And with that, you can then say, well, if they are moderately conservative, or moderate, let's just right in the middle, moderate, but they have 3 years till they really need to start drawing on this money, maybe slant them over a little bit more towards the conservative side. Whereas if they're 25 years old, we can kind of say, well, they're moderate, but you know, they have a lot of time to recoup, slant them over. So
I
think that's kind of important.
Yeah.
Now, once we get beyond this, right, so we create these portfolios, we create the asset allocation, we create the sectors, kind of put it all together, ask the question about what if I'm wrong, what if we're wrong about this direction, balance it out. The next thing is to figure out, well, what are we going to do with that, right? You're not investing in an index that or a benchmark, right? We have to invest in something. So there's a combination of mutual funds, ETFs that we use, but kind of just for just a moment, I want to talk about how actually something gets in our portfolio. And what I mean by that is, like, you get, we have maybe a sector we want, a particular asset. We go through the gyrations of whether we want it to be in a mutual fund or whether we want to be in an ETF, for example. But take me through the process of this kind of find and elimination of what we do for ETFs and mutual funds.
Yeah, so I think your first point of attack is, do I want to be or have an active strategy, or do I want to have a passive strategy?
What does that mean?
Yeah, and so what I mean by that is, you know, when you're passively investing, you're investing basically just into an index, whether it be the S&P 500, whether it be the Russell 1000 large cap, Russell small caps, Russell mid caps, but just a pure investment in an index.
That just follows it along, right? It could be the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ one. It just follows it along just wherever it goes.
It should be relatively perfectly on par with whatever that index might be. And if it's not, then you're in the wrong investment.
Right.
So, but yeah, I mean, you pay a very small fee. Passive investing is cheap. It's very cost effective. You may be paying 10 basis points. And by that, I mean 0.1%. For somebody
it's like an administrative fee.
Yeah, it's very much an administrative fee. So you have to decide first, do I want to be in an active investment where somebody is buying and selling securities underneath it, or am I just investing in the index? Now, why would I be in one versus the other? Mm-hmm. For passive investing, a lot of times there's not a lot of alpha to be generated. And what I mean by alpha is extra return that can be made.
So there's extra return compared to, let's say, the S&P. If you were investing in the S&P 500,
right,
and the S&P 500 made 8% per year on average, just as a number,
right,
the alpha would be if you had another investment that made 9% somehow. There's a risk-adjusted stuff going on there. But basically, that extra money they made because they're good at whatever they do.
Right.
The outperformance.
Yeah. And is that 1% difference worth it for the risk that you might be taking?
Right.
And in a lot of times, U.S. large caps, there isn't a lot of extra return that can be made without taking on undue risk or extra risk for that matter. So in those cases, you may want to be in more of a passive investment. So when we're talking about passive investing, that is probably one of the easiest ways to, first of all, get started. That's the easiest way to buy, to produce a low cost portfolio that is well diversified and great to get you going. You know, for young investors, this is the best.
It's easy.
It's the easiest.
Because you don't have to research. You don't have to research anything. You're like, hey, I want to be in equities, so I want to be in large cap, so I'll go with the Russell 1000 or the S&P 500, the Wilshire 5000 or whatever. Wherever you want to be, there's something for it, and it's easy to just push into that really without any thought. And it's like, okay, so I don't have to worry about and constantly think about, is this manager outperforming or not, or underperforming for that matter?
Right. Now, in an active space, you know, there is some extra risk that can be taken to produce excess return. And some of those cases would be like we talked about before, emerging markets or even small cap stocks, because you want to have a manager that has the expertise to crunch the numbers, to figure out, you know, where there might be some value, where potentially a company may be having excess growth. So, you know,
but active management has really gotten just spit on.
It has. It has as of late, that's for sure.
And I think one of the reasons is that we've discovered, you and I have done a lot of research in this, and I think this is really important to bridge this this item and really flush it out just for a moment here, which is it all depends on what markets you're in and whether or not you want to be an active versus passive. For markets that are efficient, that we have a really difficult time of beating a broad-based index, what is the point
right
of investing? What was the point of beating yourself up trying to find that one magical manager that, by the way, may only do so well for 2 to 3 years and then he just craps out?
Right.
Or she comes up with you know, a great market timing model, and then it just lasts a couple of years. It looks really well.
Right.
Kathy Woods. And then when we look at this kind of efficient market, you and I just don't have any tolerance for trying to figure out that it's impossible is the point. Right.
Right. And then you feel bad. And then you feel bad that, you know, if that manager doesn't do well and they lose 10% against the index, then you have to figure out, okay, why did that happen in the first place? Whereas if we're just with the index, a lot of times, especially in efficient markets, like you said, you're not going to be able to beat an index. It's just extremely difficult for an active manager.
So efficient markets would be U.S. large, small,
U.S. large and
large, mid.
Yeah.
Small to a lesser degree, but nothing wrong with indexing there.
Right.
Certain areas around the world that maybe there are certain equity markets to a degree, but not as much. But that's kind of like where we limit it, right? The efficient, transparent markets really are equity markets in the U.S. Then there's outside of it where you mentioned you have language barriers, you have you know, different laws and legal regulations, you have tax issues, you have political issues, you have all sorts of issues that are going on. You have dollar denomination and currency issues. You have different economic central bank issues. All of that stuff where you mentioned boots on the ground really is very helpful in determining what is the best place to be. Now, the other thing is that we did a study. We spent a lot of time crunching some numbers, and we've done it, I think, one update since, but basically looking at specifically the fixed income market.
Right.
And we questioned, we wondered, we said, hey, what is the story with fixed income? Is there any efficiency there? Is there any benefit to ETF or not to ETS because they're a lot cheaper?
Right.
And we found pretty much across the board, right, that there was a relatively consistent level of outperformance net of fees and on a risk-adjusted and absolute basis for one side of that, right?
Yeah, for active managers. Yeah. And you know, but that's also, you got to pick the right managers. But in the case of the study that we did, you know, I think we took the top 50%, not even the top, you know, 80 or 90%, and they were beating the benchmark.
Right. So we slanted it and looked at all the different things and tried to make it so that we even made it so that active management wouldn't have an edge to a point, right?
Right.
Right.
Exactly. And, you know, a lot of this has to do with the fact that fixed income markets, at least as far as I know, are pretty inefficient.
They're always been. Always been.
Spreads are wide.
Yeah.
You know, getting new issues, you need a lot of leverage, a lot of money. So, you know, if you're trying to build your own bond portfolio, I'd be pretty careful with that because, you know, trying to get bids and trying to sell bonds, you know, there's a lot of built-in pricing there that you may not get the best price. Whereas in equities, you know, we see a bid-ask spread and it's maybe a penny. In the bond world, it may be...
Oh, you don't know. It's hidden.
It may be $5.
Yeah.
You know, so...
When you talk to your bond broker, they never tell you about the actual... They talk about the fees, they talk about the ticket charge, but they never really tell you about what's the built-in deal.
Right.
So if they talk you about... especially if you've ever had a bond broker call you up and say, hey, I got a bond at 5.25%. What does that mean? Right. Like, what I compare, first of all, you got to compare it against the duration and the maturity of other bonds. Then you got to do the rating and where it is. Then you got to look at, you know, the place of it. Then you got to say, okay, well, now that I got all that information, what are similar bonds of that trading at? Then beyond that, you got to figure out, well, if this is fair, it looks reasonable, can I get this at a better price at some other broker?
Right.
Because if they embed a half a percent or even 1% on a 20-year bond,
yep,
that doesn't look like much on the upfront. But you're going to buy $50,000 of it. They may pay, you know, X amount of dollars, $500,000 commission that you don't even know because it's amortized.
Yep.
Over the length of the bond.
Yeah, having a professional money manager in the bond space is by far the way to go.
Yeah.
And you know, they create those efficiencies. They're able to buy some of those distressed securities or things that maybe an index is just trying to get rid of because it's no longer in the index. You know, do you really need to force sell something? Many times
this is what we learned. This is something we learned over the years about the forced selling with ETFs.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, many times those bonds maybe, you know, have to be forced sold because they're no longer in the Barclays Ag or they're no longer in.
Or there's redemptions, which is the biggest issue.
Right.
Redemptions cause a big problem for bonds.
Right. Exactly. And if there's no liquidity, then, you know, a lot of times these ETFs will trade at a discount versus a premium or a discount. And a lot of times on ETFs, you know, that can happen. So a lot of times you're buying an ETF where it's priced at a premium 10% above what the underlying assets actually are.
But this also gives us reason why active investors and active management in the fixed income area is so great, because I remember we had several conference calls as we were doing all this with different brokers, or the active, not brokers, but the active managers. And we talked about the liquidity problem. They're like, oh, we love it when they're for selling.
Yep.
So they have a lot more availability, and I would say they have a lot more range of what they can do in the active managers. And if they see that there's a discount or possibly some kind of a decoupling of pricing within the bond, they can go in and actually pick those off at really good prices, benefiting you as the bondholder. Let's move along here. There's a lot of things like the MPT stats and all that on, you know, people go to Morningstar and they look at these things. Important?
I would say to an extent that, yeah, they are important. You know, trying to figure out, you know, how an investment has performed on a risk-adjusted basis. You know, that's something you want to consider, whether it be the Sharpe ratio, the Sortino ratio, Trainer ratio, all these sorts of different ratios. But definitely something to consider, for sure.
So if you had to pick the top ones that you like to look at.
I mean, certainly Alpha and Sharpe are good places to start. But yeah, Sortino is also, you know, a good one. And a lot of times, you know, those are on a risk-adjusted basis.
Right. That's the whole point, the risk-adjusted.
Yep. Because it may be that manager is taking way too much risk. And yeah, while he's shooting the lights out, you know, maybe the year after that, he totally bombs it.
But the other problem is if you have a manager, which is a they, them, she, he, her. Let's get that clear.
That's right. That's
right.
We have
the pronoun fund, okay? And we have a pronoun fund that the manager is doing fine against the indices, doing fine.
Right.
However, this is always interesting to find. Their risk-adjusted scores are like weird. Like, why is this like Sharpe ratio so low?
Yeah.
So even if they're getting there, they may be getting there in a really jagged on a jagged process where they're finding a lot of highs and lows and a lot of movement around versus the straight line that was kind of
that smooth straight line versus like you say, a more volatile type of strategy. And then you know, it may also be that particular manager is not exactly investing in the quote unquote box that they should be. So you know, if you buy an emerging market manager and they're investing in U.S. equities, you know, that may be also a reason why your risk-adjusted return is quite different.
Right. How often should somebody, maybe with their 401k plan or other portfolio, like check their investments?
I would say at a very minimum, one on an annual basis.
That's not like a raw minimum. Like, yeah, just take a look
at least go look at it.
See if your login is still good.
But honestly, you know, a good place to start for somebody who's, you know, not really trying to get super involved, at least on a quarterly basis, take a look at your allocation. Make sure that it's rebalanced back to what you want it to be, that it's to its targets, and it's doing what you want it to do. You know, you should always, you know, take a look and see if there's any other managers out there that are potentially doing a better job. Has a manager left the fund?
That's always an issue. We like to look at tenure. We like to look at management tenure. As a matter of fact, that's a major issue.
Right.
We've had recently a manager who was on forever. I mean, Dan Fuss. Forever is an understatement.
he's probably quite lonely right now.
I don't know what he's doing.
I've heard he still goes back into the office.
I'm sure he does. He probably is on autopilot right to the office. The guy is like up there in age, but he's great, brilliant. But that was a big issue about a big mark on, hey, what are we going to do here, right?
Right, exactly. And that's always something you have to consider, is especially if, you know, if there's been really good performance over time and the manager's only been there for 1 year. Now he or she didn't create that performance.
Right.
So, you know, what will they do?
I remember that with the Contra Fund and the Fidelity Magellan Fund when that was managed, and any of the Peter Lynch funds, like who came after them and what was going to be like, oh my God, I wouldn't want to fill those shoes. Oh my goodness.
They would be difficult shoes to fill. That's
maybe
for sure.
Fun, but whatever.
Right.
So we're talking about rebalancing and rotation. So just quickly about rebalancing, benefits of basic rebalancing?
Yeah, rebalancing, you know, it's the true way to sell high and buy low. And, you know, as these investments go up, whether it be large caps, you know, maybe you go from a 5% position, now it's up to a 10% position. You sell that 5%, bring it back to that 5% position, and you reinvest into something that maybe has not performed as well, whether that be bonds or
whatever it may be.
Right.
Yeah. When we look at an area that people always seem to think about as like, why am I doing this? Right. You know, they come up, you know, what's the benefit of this? And that is the area of cash, holding cash in your portfolio. So right now, cash is not yielding anything to speak of. I mean, it's 0.25, 0.5.
It's minimal.
It's minimal. Is there still a reason to hold some cash or in the portfolio at times? Or I mean, we do. We hold cash in the portfolio.
Yeah, cash is a safety net. Cash also abides you the ability to find another investment that may look like it may perform well. So, you know, it's holding on to that for either the rainy day, for a safety cushion, or also if some sort of a new investment or an alternative maybe shows up, or you know, maybe the market goes down, you know, quite a bit, and you want to try and invest a little bit more money. And there's, you know, there's opportunistic.
Right. Well, I mean, so there is a reason for cash. I mean, eventually one day, maybe in our lifetimes, there will be return on cash again. I remember back then.
Yeah, certainly 2000, I think 2000 to 2005, where they were paying 5% or something like that in money markets.
Right.
It was amazing for those that had cash. It was, you know, basically a risk-free return.
So what about these hot hands, these Momo FOMO investing with managers? We talked about this a little bit. It's okay for a small amount to do that, right? I mean, even it's not going to bust your diversification up and your finely laid out plan to have a spec area in the portfolio.
No, and that's what I said earlier. I think it's, you know, it's a good place for people to learn. And certainly, you know, you may produce some excess return there, but you also don't want to create, you know, your whole portfolio based around all these Momo names, because certainly we've seen in the past these Momo names go up like crazy, but we've also seen them crash back down.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question about that. Let's kind of switch gears and talk about for a second here the there's a lot of these interesting, maybe it's a sign of the times, but these interesting, they're not even alternatives. I don't know what they're called, but like these ETFs that offer downside protection, or, you know, like the thermostat fund that we know about, or maybe even some of these buffers and or even these volatility-based investments that try to come up with a balance so that it's like heads I win, tails you lose, right? You know what right. I mean?
I mean, nowadays, there's more investment options out there than you can think of. It's almost like the Lloyd's of London that, you know, if you have an idea,
yeah,
there's an ETF out there probably for it. And yeah. And many times with what you're talking about, these buffered ETFs or that have some downside protection, whether it be, you know, if the S&P falls down 10%, it kind of shuts off. But they get expensive. And that's yeah. one of the problems with them is that you're going to pay, you know, maybe 2% for an ETF to manage that risk. And a lot of times they're using options in order to offset some of those downside risks or...
But it's not just the fee. The question is also, is it because our managed growth strategy isn't the cheapest strategy around. It's a little bit different, runs long short. But it's not just the fee. It's also, is it gimmicky?
It is gimmicky. And there's also a lot of complexities that are involved with it. It's like the old structured products that you've seen back in the day where the prospectus was 200 pages and most of it you couldn't understand.
Up. Right. I never understood them.
Right. And you were locked up for 10 years or whatever it might be. Now they've just wrapped that up and put it into an ETF form that's got daily liquidity. That's fine and all. But, you know, many times you may see some volatility based on options. You don't know what the underlying risks might be.
Right.
It could be tied to the VIX.
Unknowns.
Yeah. I mean, it's just.
But that's what we try to do anyway with our, this is the whole point of what we're talking about right now is kind of like putting away the need for something like that as a gimmick, as opposed to really setting up a core portfolio, maybe utilizing those and some of the hot hand and Momo FOMOs and memes and all of those as an adjunct additional part of that segment that covers your alternative. Because a lot of times what we do is if we get a portfolio in for a client, let's say it's $1 million, what we'll do is we'll put them within our global allocations, but carve out a piece of it for our alternative strategy, which gives them a whole different flavor for what is going on. Long short, individual equities, hedging positions, trading kind of adds multi-layered dimension.
Right.
To it all. So
yep. Yeah, so it's all about balancing that risk,
right.
Balancing the time horizon and building that portfolio, sticking with it and trying to create those smooth returns over time.
Right. Good stuff. Hey, Kevin, it's been a pleasure as always. You've got to do this more often. You know, I mean, you're right in the office. So it's always like we're always getting other guests and all that. But I always get really great feedback when you're on. So
happy to be here.
That's great. So, all right. Hey, thanks so much for doing this. And I'll see you in 5 minutes.
All right.
And that's a wrap. We're going to finish it right there. Hopefully you got all the information you need to at least get some of the understanding of what is diversification, what's it all about, and how does it actually work. So anyway, thanks for joining me this week. Again, I'll see you again next week. Happy Memorial Day. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.